This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
So we're behind the scenes at Stargazing Live from Jodrell Bank, and we're with Professor Lucy Green from MSSL. Hi, Lucy.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us for the third time now on the Jodcast. You were one of our early interviewees in 2007, and then again in 2012, and now we have you in the first month of 2016, so welcome.
Yeah, it's nice to be on the anniversary version.
Yeah, yeah, so exactly, the Jodcast is turning 10,
tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, on the day we record. So, back in 2012, it seems weird to say that, but we had you on and you talked to us a lot about your sort of area of research, which is coronal mass ejections and how those affect space weather and how they cause aurorae and that sort of thing. So maybe you could just start by giving us an overview of what you've basically sort of been doing in the last 3 and a bit years.
Yeah, it's quite scary to think that 2012 is now 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And I still work on coronal mass ejections. I'm still fascinated by them and have lots of questions that I want to answer. So just as a sort of intro to what they are, these are the eruptions, not only of plasma, electrically charged gas, but also magnetic field from the sun's atmosphere. And it's been a quest since they were discovered in the 1970s to explain why they happen. And to sort of give you an illustration of how challenging the question is, they involve around 10 to the 25 joules of energy. They can accelerate material that has the same mass as that of a mountain into the solar system at speeds of up to a few thousand kilometers a second. So huge kinetic energy is involved. And what was realized in the years afterwards was that the energy must come from that stored in the magnetic field. There's no other energy reservoir that can power these events. So then the question has been, well, how does that energy get released? How is it transferred from energy in the magnetic field into this kinetic energy that takes this material and the magnetic field out into the solar system? And that's what I've been working on over the last 4 years. So when would it have been? Before that, probably the last time I came on, I might have talked about magnetic flux ropes. And these are bundles of magnetic field. You can visualize them as being like a rope, you know, helical threads woven together. And a magnetic flux rope does what it says on the tin, is this bundle of helical magnetic field lines. And they trap plasma within them. But they're really interesting when it comes to coronal mass ejections, because when you look at the physics of flux ropes and the configurations they take on in the solar atmosphere, they can become unstable. And so that's the sort of thing that I've been working on. Do they form in the sun's atmosphere? How do they form? And do they indeed become unstable? And it's a challenging question. So to give you a bit more information about why it's so challenging, you can't measure the magnetic fields in the sun's atmosphere where these flux ropes are forming. So what we do is try and use other observational data as a proxy for the magnetic field.
Sure.
And we take advantage of the fact that the magnetic field traps hot plasma. And so if we look at that glowing hot plasma, we can work from that and understand the magnetic field configurations. And we combine that with direct measurements of the magnetic field at the surface of the sun. And so I use those observations, and my students are involved in using those observations. And then we also have a researcher called Gerardo Valori who works with us, and he makes extrapolations of the magnetic field. And so what we've been doing is, between us, we've been working out how much magnetic flux is captured in these flux ropes and why they might become unstable. At what point do they start to erupt?
Okay, so it might not be exactly obvious to our listeners how you go about measuring the magnetic field at the surface of the sun, for example. So how does that happen?
Yeah, it's a good question, because magnetic fields in themselves feel very abstract.
Sure.
And, you know, they're invisible, so how do you see them? And we capitalise on the fact that if an object which is glowing also has a magnetic field, it puts a fingerprint into the light that it's emitting. And in particular, it polarises the light. And so, I don't know, in the same way as you might wear Polaroid glasses to reduce glare from polarised light coming off of water, we can use polarising filters to measure the polarisation of light coming from the sun. And that tells us about the magnetic field, the strength of the magnetic field, the direction, because magnetic fields are vector quantities, so they have a direction too. So in the most reliable method that we use, we can make a map of the photosphere, which is the glowing visible surface of the sun. And we use the polarization technique, and you create a magnetic map of that layer. So it's just sort of a layer of the sun. It's not a three-dimensional map of the magnetic field. It's just at the photosphere, and it tells us how strong the field is and whether it's pointing into the sun or out of the sun. And you might have heard of sunspots already, so these features in the photosphere. And they are regions of very strong magnetic fields. So when we make our magnetic maps, we see the strongest fields in the sunspot regions.
So you mentioned sunspots, and one thing that always comes to mind is that the sun has these sunspot cycles, which vary over the period of years. When you look at your data, have you been looking at it for 4 years? Is it 4 years of constant data? Have you found any periods of your own?
Yeah, so the sunspot cycle, you're absolutely right. The number varies over time, and it rises and falls over, on average, an 11-year cycle. So we are interested in looking at how the magnetic fields vary across the cycle. And, yeah, are there any changes or any periodicities in that? And one thing that we see is that when the sun is creating sunspots in the rising phase of the cycle, they can be... The language we would use is sort of simpler, so they can have more simple magnetic field configurations than in the declining phase. So there's some sense from the observations that the sun's magnetic field becomes more tangled and twisted, forming very complex sunspot regions in the declining phase. So that's interesting for me, because this tangledness and twistedness in the magnetic field is important for building up magnetic flux ropes that ultimately erupt as a coronal mass ejection. And so I want to understand, is it more likely to build up flux ropes in the declining phase, or are there processes that happen all through the solar cycle to produce these flux ropes? Because indeed we see coronal mass ejections forming all through the solar cycle. The number rises and falls with the number of sunspots, but there's still an open question of the mechanisms that form these eruptive structures. Are they always the same, or do we need to be thinking about different models?
So actually, you mentioned models, and I was about to move on to that. As in any sort of field of astrophysics nowadays, modelling probably plays a pretty big part. How do you work with models? Are you taking your data and then trying to build that into recreating how a coronal mass ejection forms, or how does it sort of work?
Yeah, so models are so, so important. And it makes me think back to a time when I was just starting in solar physics, and I went to a conference where we had loads of observations being presented on coronal mass ejections, lots of observations taken with what we call coronagraph telescopes. So these are telescopes that create an artificial solar eclipse. They block the disk of the sun, the photosphere, and they reveal the atmosphere. And then you see these eruptions moving away very clearly. And somebody got up and said, look, we've got all these observations now, but our modelling and our theoretical knowledge needs to be developed. And it was a real plea to the community. And then here we are today, many years later, and we have fantastic models that evolve the magnetic field in ways so that we can understand the stability or loss of stability. So we call them MHD models, for magnetohydrodynamics, so how the magnetic field within this plasma is evolving. And they have been telling us about the physics of coronal mass ejections and making predictions about, okay, if this is really what the real sun is doing, then we should observe these particular features. And so a lot of what I do takes the theoretical and the modelled predictions and looks back into the solar atmosphere to say, okay, do we see this, and which of the models are correct?
So moving back very quickly to the flux ropes, when you mentioned that they become unstable and then they erupt and form these coronal mass ejections, what is actually happening? Is it that the magnetic fields are combining and releasing energy, or is it that plasma is following magnetic fields out further away from the sun?
Yeah, so I think it comes down to magnetic forces. So the question is, yeah, how do you erupt this material up so that it is able to overcome the force of gravity, which is pulling the plasma back down to the surface of the sun? And the magnetic field has a force that it exerts on the plasma, and it is able to overcome gravity. And the way that I conceptualize it is to think of my twisted flux rope that is anchored in the sun at both ends. So I've got my sort of rope, which is a bit curved, and it's rooted in the sun in two points, and that's the structure that's going to erupt as the coronal mass ejection. And the magnetic forces on that curved and twisted structure actually point up. So it does want to try and escape, but it could do that very slowly. It could gradually rise up. But what we need for a coronal mass ejection is a catastrophic eruption.
So it repels the plasma from the sun.
Yes, well, the magnetic field carries the plasma with it. Another sort of way that I think about it is it being a bit like a magnetic hammock, that it's captured the plasma, and if you raise the hammock, it takes the plasma up with it. But when it comes to looking at these magnetic structures in the sun's atmosphere, so you've got your twisted flux rope, which is rooted in the surface of the sun, but then above that and wrapping over the top and down the sides of it, you've got other magnetic fields. The sun's atmosphere is completely full of magnetic field, and those magnetic fields look more like an arch. So they run over the top of the flux rope, and their magnetic forces are pointing down towards the sun. So you've got this competition of the flux rope that wants to go up and the magnetic arcade that wants to trap the flux rope and keep it down on the sun. So what we've been doing with the observations is to try and understand at what point does the upward force on the flux rope win? When is the overlying magnetic field no longer able to keep it down on the surface of the sun? And what we would like to be able to do is work towards a predictive capability so that we understand the physics enough that then we can start looking at these flux ropes forming and saying, okay, they've had a certain amount of magnetic field built in and the magnetic field above has evolved in a certain way, and we know that that tipping point is going to come very soon and be able to predict when an eruption will happen.
Fantastic. So I guess to build up these predictive models, you'll need ever better observations. And one of the advantages of solar physics as opposed to other astrophysics is that the sun isn't that far away compared to some other objects, so we can actually send spacecraft there. And I think, so you're involved in the Solar Orbiter project, which is the plan to do exactly that. So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Solar Orbiter is a hugely exciting mission. Uh-huh. And we're coming into the final leg of the build phase now, which makes it even more exciting. It's really tangible. We've got instruments that are being built right now. So we've had engineering models built, tests have been done, and we're working towards the flight models that will be integrated onto the spacecraft. They're due for delivery later on this year, towards the end of the year. But the Solar Orbiter mission in itself is so exciting because it's going to fly very close to the sun, so around the orbit of Mercury. And that might not sound so close for some people, but it's now, what's Mercury? Around one third of the distance roughly between the sun and the Earth, one quarter to one third, I've forgotten exactly now. So the amount of radiation that Solar Orbiter will receive is then, you follow the inverse square law, many times higher than what we receive at the Earth. And so at its closest approach to the sunward side will heat up to around 600 degrees Celsius. And that presents a huge engineering challenge. Now, the orbit, in fact, takes it close to the sun and then out to the orbit of the Earth, and it goes in close again and out and in and out. So all the time you've got those thermal stresses on the spacecraft. Yeah. And it's also a fantastic mission because not only is it taking images of the sun, so it might be looking at these source regions of coronal mass ejections, but it also has instruments on board that measure the magnetic field and the plasma around the spacecraft. So you could imagine that in principle it could be looking at the sun, it could see a coronal mass ejection leave, it could see a flux rope erupt, and then what would it be? Maybe, I don't know, a few hours later or half a day later, that material and magnetic field would pass over the spacecraft. Right. And we'd be able to sense the magnetic field and the plasma and ask the question, or measure directly, does it have the magnetic field that we expected it to have when it left the sun? Does it match our predictions, or perhaps has it evolved as it's moved out through the solar system? So Solar Orbiter is a mission that will link up what we see on the sun and what actually leaves the sun, because we'll be measuring it directly.
Will you also be able to see how it's evolved further if, by some chance, the coronal mass ejection occurred so that it passed through Earth as well?
That would be fantastic. If we could see something at the sun, measure it close in with Solar Orbiter, then it moves out, we measure it at the Earth, and who knows, maybe we pick it up with instrumentation at Mars or Saturn. You know, it just depends what the configuration of the planets is, where these different missions are, and how the ejection goes out from the sun. And we've had this before, where you see things leaving the sun and then you pick it up in multiple spacecraft. And even if they're not perfectly aligned, the coronal mass ejections expand to be so massive that you might have a spacecraft at the Earth that measures the central part, you might have a spacecraft at Venus that measures, you know, the left flank of it, and you might have a spacecraft at Mars that measures the right flank, and then you could put them all together and try and understand the much bigger picture of the three-dimensional structure.
Obviously, coronal mass ejections have a consequence for Earth, because when they do pass through us, they create what we call space weather, I guess, and so that creates a worry, but also it has a possibility to interfere with electrical devices. And so maybe that would be a bit of a mixed blessing if we do get a high-powered one that comes towards Earth, and there are also, I guess, not so good consequences.
Yeah, it is like that. It's one of those things that, as a scientist, you want to experience or see all possibilities. So I want to be able to see the average event, I want to be able to see the small events, but I also want to be able to see the really big, energetic, impressive events. But you're right, they're the ones that can cause us the biggest problems. So the fast-moving coronal mass ejections, lots of magnetic flux, lots of plasma, they're the ones that cause the damage. And, you know, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that we would be looking at such a massive event, and it could cause problems for the spacecraft that are sent up to monitor it.
Sure.
So solar orbiter, being that close to the sun, is going to get bombarded.
You did mention that it's going to get incredibly hot, and then if it's sitting through massive ejections at multiple points as well, do you know much about the engineering and the challenges that are involved and how they're going to get around some of these problems?
Yeah, so luckily we have so much heritage in the UK and experience of space missions and launching instrumentation that works for many, many years. So as an example, another mission that we're involved with at MSSL is the Hinode spacecraft. It's a Japanese mission, but it has a UK-led instrument that we lead on board, and it has contribution from America and also, of course, Japan as well. And Hinode launched in 2006 and is still operational. And indeed, the SOHO spacecraft that launched in 1995 and carries UK instruments on board, that's still operational. So we have good expertise and a track record of building kit that works. But you're right, going that much closer to the sun means you need more shielding. And Solar Orbiter has this very impressive heat shield on the front of it that's, I don't know, I think it's about 3.5 meters by 2.5 meters, something like that. And then for the imaging telescopes, they have little holes that the telescopes look through. So you limit the heat flux coming into your telescopes. And then there are also interesting things like the solar panels. So the way the spacecraft gets its electricity is through sunlight falling on the solar panels. And when it's close to the sun, the solar panels can turn away slightly so that they're not feeling the full onslaught of the solar radiation. And then when it comes out to the orbit of the Earth, they can turn and face the sun fully. So you can modulate how much light is falling on them.
So roughly, what's the timeline of Solar Orbiter like at the moment?
So at the moment, I've been working on what's called the structural thermal model, so that when it comes to building instruments for space, you never just build the flight model straight off. There are always models that are used for testing. So to make sure that all the electronics work, to make sure that the thermal aspects work, to make sure, well, that everything is going to go seamlessly once you've launched it. So the flight models, which will be the ones that go up, they are due to be delivered by the end of 2016, the end of this year, and they will go to be put on the spacecraft by Airbus Defence and Space in Stevenage. So the Solar Orbiter spacecraft itself is being supplied by the UK, and that's a hugely important thing for us. So British engineers and scientists are building that spacecraft, and everything will be integrated and tested, and then launch is due for 2018.
Do you know much about the orbit that the Solar Orbiter is going to be taking at the moment? Is it going to be sort of locked in tandem with Earth, so it's always being able to send its messages back to Earth? Or is the sun going to be in the way part of the time so that we're not going to be able to get information? Is it going to store stuff up, and whenever there's a good line of sight between us and the satellite, it's going to send everything back that it can?
The orbits are really interesting, and it was an eye-opener to me just how much work goes into that aspect. So depending on when you launch and where the planets are, because we need to use Venus as a gravitational slingshot to get into this very eccentric orbit, this elliptical orbit that takes it close at one point and then out towards the Earth at the other point. And the other aspect is that the orbit will be over time inclined with respect to the plane in which the planets go around the sun. So it will lift up and be able to see over the poles of the Earth. And it will take around 3 years to get into the position where we're having an orbit that takes us, you know, just around the orbit of Mercury. So not all the instruments will be turned on when we launch in 2018. The in-situ instruments will come on first because they can make measurements as they move through the solar system. But the remote sensing, I'm not sure for all of them, but certainly some of them will only be turned on later in the mission. And then, because it's going to be a very remote spacecraft for us, we have limitations when it comes to how much data can be returned. So we won't just be able to take loads and loads of lovely images like we do at the moment with a mission like the Solar Dynamics Observatory, which is in constant contact with the ground station, constantly sending back data. On Solar Orbiter, you're right, there will be times when you can send the data back, but it won't be all the time. We'll be limited by the fact that it's in this orbit and where it is in relation to us. So we won't be able to look at the sun throughout its orbit. There will be sort of 2 or 3 weeks at a time where we'll be watching the sun, gathering data and sending it back.
Well, Lucy, it's been a pleasure having you talking about the sun, and good luck for the Solar Orbiter, although I'm sure you won't need it and everything will go fine.
Fingers crossed. I won't be relaxed until it's actually working, so launched and in the right orbit and working.
Well, hopefully you'll be able to come back to the Jodcast for your Hawth interview and tell us about how all the awesome results that you have from it.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.